Continuing with Frank Kerr on October 3rd, 1971. And we're talking about the first radar astronomy in Australia. And you decided not to work with meteors because that would be too much of an effort, you said?
Well, it didn't sound especially interesting as compared with the other more astronomical things that were going on. We thought we wanted to get outside the Earth. But however, we did do a bit of looking around, and when I say we, the other person involved in that was Alec Shane, the C.A. Shane. And we did some looking for various mysterious echoes that had been reported either during the war or before the war. The famous long delay echoes that were supposed to have come in after about 27 seconds or 32 seconds, that sort of thing, studied by Van der Pol about 1932, that were and still are a complete mystery.
Still are, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. Are they still observed?
No. Well, they're not still observed, and it's not quite clear whether they didn't exist or whether it's because there's just too much clutter in the radio spectrum now, so you've got no chance of getting them. There are two possibilities there. However, the fact that we didn't see them, and also somebody else at Cambridge, England, was doing a study about that time pretty systematically to try and find them, also suggests that perhaps they were something spurious. But they were reported by Van der Pol in Holland, somebody in Sweden, and also somebody in Indochina. And there were theories that these things were perhaps something connected with the ionosphere, that in some way they'd collected a very low group velocity and low attenuation, and some funny mode of propagation in the upper ionosphere, or alternatively, that they might be connected with the Stürmer ring of particles. That was a favorite thing at that time, of the few Earth radii out from the Earth.
Right.
But we didn't ever see anything. We also kind of looked for the Gegenschein and a few other odd little goodies like that without any success. But say we decided to have a go at the moon, especially as just about that time the first echoes from the moon were obtained by obtained in this country by the US Army Signal Corps people at what's the place called in New Jersey?
Fort Monmouth?
Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Project Diana. They were working at something about 1.5 meters or something like that. And the interesting thing that came out of their work, theirs was really an engineering type study, and they didn't follow it up much astronomically.
Was it published in any form?
Well, the Sky and Telescope is the main publication I can recall. I think it was probably in the IRE proceedings at that time too. That's about 1947. And they got echoes, and the interesting thing to us was that the echoes were reported to vary in strength and to be consistently lower than they in strength than they anticipated. And so we thought that seemed interesting to study. And because it was quite likely that the variations were, at least in part, in the ionosphere, it was worth doing it at a long wavelength. Also, by doing it at a long wavelength, we could get a free transmitter that is much stronger than ours. And we made arrangements with Radio Australia, that's the shortwave broadcasting service, and to borrow one of their transmitters, which Shepparton, Victoria, in the small hours of the morning when they happened to be not using it.
I see.
In the small hours of the morning was a good time to get through the ionosphere at low angle. Of course, a broadcast station transmits at low angle because that's where it wants to go. And so we keyed this broadcast transmitter by landline from a station that we specially set up near Sydney. At least this was the place where we had been doing this radar work anyway, in a valley near Sydney, about 20 miles north of Sydney, a place called Hornsby. This incidentally perhaps answers your earlier question about space, about places specially set up for radio astronomy. This was one of the two or three places specially set up for radio astronomy work. And it was specially for this radar work. We didn't want to be in the same place as any receiving station.
Right.
It was an enclosed valley, which was quite a good place. And we set up a rhombic antenna there that we used for receiving, and we pointed that towards San Francisco. This was because we used the particular transmitting antenna at the broadcast station that was also directed towards San Francisco.
And what frequency was this now?
This was at either 18 point something or 18.7 or 21.5 megahertz. We operated on one or both of those frequencies, sometimes simultaneously, and sometimes only one of them. And we could only work at particular times. There was this was one way in which we learned our astronomy. We learned out all of it. We learned all about the motions of the moon at that stage. We demonstrated to ourselves that this particular system could only work on about 3 or 4 days per month, such that the moon would be in the beam in the early morning hours, in which the transmitter was not being used. The transmitter, at least that particular transmitter and antenna system, were not being used.
Right.
So there's a total of about 20 days in the year on which we could using this system. And so we studied echoes from the moon.
You had no trouble obtaining them?
Well, we had trouble. In fact, the first night we were doing it, we didn't succeed, which was a pity, a disappointment for the representative of the Australian Broadcasting Commission, who was also in our very small trailer. That he gave up and didn't come the second night when we did receive them.
Right.
Instead he phoned us and asked us about it, and we told him, and so sure enough he got his story, but he wasn't there. He came out later and recorded some of the sounds and so on. But that was sort of fun. And
well, that might be the first radio astronomical recording.
Yes, it probably was one of the first. I've still got a copy of it. And we showed that the signals were almost always much less than expected, often about 10 dB less.
Now what were you using, just a sort of a dirt composition for the lunar surface? For the index
Well, we said it would be about 15% reflection coefficient, which was a sort of reasonable dirt here. And we didn't know much at that time as to whether it was a rough or a smooth reflector either. It was another thing that has become much better understood since. But we studied the variations with time, and we showed that there were short-term variations, a few seconds, up to a minute or so, up to about 30 seconds perhaps. But the short-term variations were connected with the moon's libration. So we had to understand all about vibration. And there was longer period fading of the order of minutes that correlated with the critical frequency of the F2 region of the ionosphere. So we separated those two out, and
the libration was just a difference in distance that was causing the change, or
no, it was interference between reflection from different parts.
Oh, I see, different aspects of the faces of the moon. Yes.
So it showed that the moon was to some extent at least a rough reflector, and we were getting interference between reflections from different points on the moon.
Different sub-Earth points, yeah.
And that the moon was in effect rotating relative to us through its libration, plus our motion.
Right.
That libration was an important part of it. And this rotation of the moon gave varying interference.
Right.
And so this produced a fading.
And where was this published?
That's also in the proceedings of the IRE, about 1949 or early 50.
Was this, had other people meanwhile been bouncing stuff off the moon too, or was this the second?
The second one that was well known, but there's a mysterious project by somebody called Bay, Zed Bay.
B-A-Y?
The B-A-Y in Hungary. And this has never been published anywhere properly. Nobody ever knows, has ever been able to find out much about it. In fact, the only report of it we ever knew was via some Soviet publication. And this was a terribly marginal experiment. They had no proper receiver, and they had some electrochemical sort of gadget, and so the moon echoes appeared as a slightly increased production of hydrogen or something.
Or a change in colour of the receiver.
But at least this man always gets a mention in any historical statement. It's rather interesting that one of the Project Diana people, a man called Webb, I met him by chance in 67 at Arecibo when I visited there for a week, and he was just visiting temporarily, but he's now at the University of Illinois, and I met him again last year there.
Connected at all with radio astronomy?
He has come back again into radio astronomy just the last few years. He's been in electrical engineering ever since, and he's still really in their electrical engineering department.
Right.
But sort of carried over on the coattails of George Swenson into astronomy.
So you didn't feel any great competition then while you were doing this moon?
It was a sort of isolated project, really. And it wasn't until some years afterwards that they started, perhaps a year or so afterwards, that they started some of this at Jodrell Bank. And by that time, transmitters were starting to be developed, especially for this radar work, and they were more powerful, and gradually became more powerful.
And what year was this for the Jodrell Bank now?
I guess probably about 54 or so that they really got into it. The first person really involved was Jack Evans, who's been at the Lincoln Lab for a long time,
right.
The J.B. Evans. And he was their first one at Jodrell Bank.
Now, your moon radar experiments then were in 52, 53?
No, 46. It started at the end of 46 and went through all of 47.
That's what I thought. You said Jodrell was a year or so after.
I think I was wrong. I don't think it started until the 50s.
Okay. I thought we were earlier.
Yes, I think I must have been wrong there. Yes, it was later. That's why they were able to start getting more powerful transmitters. More technical advances in transmitting in the meantime. And after our moon work, I spent the next year, in the study and writing up all the moon work, and also in thinking about the possibilities of echoes from the sun and the planets. And we worked out the theory of all of that, and there's a classical paper that they're called on the possibility of radar echoes from the sun and planets. That's also in PROC IRE, at around that time, 1950 it would be, I suppose.
By whom?
By me. And that's the sort of classical paper on this. But we ourselves eventually decided not to get into the business because it was quite clear it involved building a pretty expensive transmitter and antenna system, and we decided to stay on the passive side and concentrate on the receiving stuff, because in the meantime it had been going ahead so far. Then at that stage I personally went to Harvard for a year, and partly again with the idea of getting into astronomy a bit, finding out more astronomy. And I happened to be there when Ewan and Purcell detected the 21 centimeter line.
I see.
And Van der Hulst was there at that time too, but he was on a visiting professorship for a semester, and we were both called across to Purcell's office on the morning after Ewan had detected the line in the small hours of the morning that same day. And Purcell was very keen to have this discovery confirmed before he published it. He was the cautious physicist type.
Right.
So Van der Hulst sent a cable to Oort, and I sent a cable to Causey reporting this, and the Dutch were of course very disappointed that somebody had beaten them to it, because they'd been working on it for much longer, and they really deserved to get there first. And they would have, but some of their equipment was destroyed by fire, apparently.
Right.
But this spurred them on to even greater efforts, and a couple of weeks later they succeeded in detecting it too. The cable I sent to Sydney apparently stirred them all up, and Pawsey decided the line had to be found instantly, and Christensen and Hindman got onto it, and they lashed up this receiver pretty quickly in a trailer out at a station called Potts Hill, which I'll come back to some other time, because it had already been working as a radio astronomy setup for 2 or 3 years by then.
This is the one with the row of dishes.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And they set up this 21 centimeter line equipment in a trailer, a single channel gadget, of course, at that stage. And they found the line after about 6 weeks. But of course, they had already equipment working somewhere near that wavelength, and they had the expertise to do it all, and they got it going fairly quickly.
And Purcell held off until there was confirmation from both of them.
Well, he held off until there was confirmation from Holland, and then those two groups prepared their papers and sent them in. And in the publication in Nature, it's got these two papers plus a cable from Pawsey that reports the further confirmation in Sydney.
Did you know about the project before they found it?
Well, I didn't know about it until I got to Harvard.
But
I knew about it a few months before, yes.
I see.
And I was in on this gossip. I guess you've heard this story of you and the negative report first, haven't you?
No, I don't think I have.
Who
tell?
It was his PhD project, of course, thesis project. And after a certain time, he came back to Purcell and reported failure, that he could not detect the line. And asked him what to do. Could he turn in this negative result as a thesis? And Purcell was a very wise physicist, and he said, yes, I'll accept the negative thesis, but it must be 10 times as good as the positive result. And so go back and check hard. And so Ewan went back and checked, and sure enough, in due course, he improved his sensitivity, and he found the line.
Well, he actually did improve the equipment. It was a sensitivity problem.
Or stability or something. This was done with a horn that was poked out a window of the Lyman lab at Harvard.
Right.
A good name, of course, Lyman, for this.
Yeah.
And the sky drifted past, and in the Milky Way, in Ophiuchus or somewhere, it came past at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on that famous day in March 1951.
So, now what were you doing at Harvard? Were you getting a master's degree? Or?
No, I just went for a year to get involved in astronomy. I did get a master's degree, but I didn't go there really with the intention of getting it. I went there with the idea of spending a while in contact with astronomy. Menzel talked me into acting as a graduate student and actually taking courses and signing up. Actually, when I went, I hadn't really intended to do that. But as it turned out, I ended up with a master's degree. This was partly because I passed their PhD qualifying at the end of the year, so that was what really gave it, I guess. So then, when I came back, I ended up at Harvard in the northern summer of 1951, and came back via Europe. And I looked in at Cambridge and Jodrell Bank and Leiden and so on the way, getting more contact with the other radio astronomers. And we got back, I suppose, end of September 51. And at that stage, Christensen and Hindman had just completed their first rough survey of the 21 centimeter line radiation from the southern sky, which was published in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research. And Christensen wanted to get back to his solar work, and I took over the interest in 21 centimeter work, and I guess I've more or less been there ever since in one form or another. So that's the early period as far as I was concerned. But you probably want to hear some other time about the setting up of the other stations near Sydney.
Yeah, particularly Parkes, of course.
The early...
And the other...
The early work at Fox Hill and Nepto and Flers. And then the other one, and later on Parkes, yes.
Now, who were the people that were working at these other stations between 45 and 50 that I assume they haven't been mentioned yet?
Well, MacCready. Where's the entrance to this
right, place? Right here, yeah.
Yes, MacCready and Ruby Payne Scott. And Len Dobby for a while, and Lahaney, Fred Lahaney, and Yabsley, they were both involved in early solar work in particular.
And Christensen, I guess.
And Christensen. Although Christensen actually came into it some time later. Christensen was not in it in a very early time. He did not join the lab until about 1948 or 49. He was at AWA, Amalgamated Wireless, Australasia.
I know them. They're the contractors that run Carnarvon.
Oh, yes.
Yes, they're still the biggest radio company, I guess. I don't think they're doing as much research work now as they used to. This is the old problem. It's so difficult to compete with the bigger RCA and Bell Labs and so on, that they tend to adopt things from other places rather than take it themselves. But at least at that time, they had a fairly big concern. And they were connected with radar too, because they made all these highly mobile little warning sets.
And they still do a lot of radar work.
Yeah.
Well, like I say, that was all the people at Man Carnarvon were employees of AWA.
Oh yes, I see. They were the contractors.
Right. Well, I think that's a good breaking point. Unless you
okay.
There's something else to say.
A few other things we could do some other time.
We have arrived at Hojo's. We're ready to check in. So thank you.
All right.
Okay, we're now continuing over martini and clams.
Now, as you're going to be a Dutchman shortly, you should know that the present day is a very famous day in Leiden.
Is this the day they have the big festival?
Yes, 3 October. It's the anniversary of the relief of the siege of the city by the Spaniards.
Yeah, Chris has described the...
There's a famous holiday. You want to try and get there one day.
Celebration of it.
A year. I suppose every city's got something like it. It's a special one. Well, let's see. We start talking about the fire station.
Ignore this, I haven't
heard of that yet. Okay. It's worth prefacing the story of the Parkstish by saying that the history of radio astronomy in Australia in the early days was very much connected with the development of ideas in electrical engineering and physics. That's especially in the early days, the principal contribution was in developing new antenna systems, and generally in the form of arrays. And of course, the cross and the various things connected with that are an example of it, and the wild spectrum analyzer, and so on. A great deal of the inspiration for all this goes back to Pawsey with his history. And it's worth saying this because there was great opposition to the idea of developing a big dish inside the lab. It was Taffy Bowen who was very keen on the idea of a big dish. This was often unkindly said as being in the sense that he wanted it as a status symbol for the lab and himself. In particular, in the early days, it was always jokingly said that the diameter